So the title of this talk is Sky Dances. Sky Dances. And before we begin, I wanted to pay homage to all the women, all the women of the past, and all the women of the present, and all the women of the future, that will wake up and have woken up for the benefit of all of us. And I just ask all these women and all these Dakinis in all the world in the next 5 days to continue to bestow blessings on all of us. So in this talk, I'm going to be exploring female embodiment of awakening. And this has been quite a sensitive realm for myself, in for some time not really knowing if I wanted to be a woman or not. And so, but deciding that actually it's something very lovely. And something that has its own uniqueness and what it can give to this inner process for men and women alike. So I've spoken a little, I've touched on a little, I think, in almost all of my talks on Dakinis. So I wanted to go into this more. So Dakinis are sometimes in the tantric texts called sky dancers, hence the title. And they're often unconventional women who have generated a very awesome sense of fearlessness and love. You could say that through the depth of their practice, they've risen out of the shape of victimhood, that they've moved out of that gravity into something else, that they've allowed the depth of their sweetness and their nectar to flow, so there's a deep resting in a sense of safety. That they're resting in very clear, bright awareness. One woman came to a talk yesterday or the day before and said that she'd begun to feel herself as a transparent mountain. So felt a very deep stability that still had a lot of room and porousness for phenomena and all the movements of the mind to come and go. So I think these women are like transparent mountains. They're often very wild looking in the texts. So twigs are all in the hair. They're often naked. So they're often unclothed. And it's said like they're dressed in the sky. But here we could feel that it's really fearlessly being able to sit with no thought, so allowing a depth of nakedness to be revealed. There's no hiding. It said their eyes blaze with passion and ferocious intensity. And very clearly and directly, they can spark a connection for those they come into contact with reality, very directly, like a kind of poof, a zap, and something's opened. They're often, as well as sky dancers, they're called sky women. So women who fly, women who revel in a kind of sky-like freedom, where self-harassment, the onrush of self-criticism and the way we torture ourselves has ceased. So men can also feel themselves as these women through this talk. And as we proceed, men's role will become a little clearer in how these women assist all of us. They're also called female messengers, that they're bringing in the news, like portals to God, delivering the news that we need to hear. They delight in the pleasure that they are untamable. So there's a delight in being wild. And they're often called heroines in these tantric texts that I've been looking over, just wanting to share this with you in the last days. And they're called heroines because they have reclaimed this sense of shameless divinity, that divine pride that I've been speaking about. And the other day Ajayji was speaking about humility, and I said to him afterwards, oh, you know, I've been speaking about this divine pride, and a few people had come to me and said, you know, how does this humility and divine pride meet? And we sort of were exploring that they're exactly the same thing. Like through the humility, the divine pride can rise up. Like the divine pride is so natural, like so natural to take pride in the depth of what we really are. It's a cutting off of the ego and resting somewhere else that is really divine, that does have a humility with it as well. So these women have also been spoken about, not in such nice ways, but they've been called sluts in the culture, debauched, so like reveling kind of disgustingly in pleasure. They've been called depraved, like sex maniacs, and they've been called lewd. Lewd? Do you know what that means? Lewd. Jane?
Same.
The same. The same as the other thing.
It's a polite way of saying depraved.
But there's this sense that it's this feeling, and that we've all felt, of deeply resting back in yourself, moving out of the expectation of others and planting your dignity in your own seat. So these women are no longer its, but something of themselves, something full unto themselves. And I have just one quote, and it's from an Australian writer speaking about the movie Orlando that Virginia Woolf wrote, and then it became the movie Orlando. And it's this striking moment, I think, where she sees something, where this woman in this movie kind of reflects this Dakini-like sense. This woman, this writer, is watching this movie, Orlando, and she says, there's a lovely sequence where the camera traces gently along the curves of her natural haunches, sorry, not her naked haunches, her torso, her shoulder, and stops at her eyes, which are wide open, alert, looking straight at us. The jolt of this, the gazed upon, without aggression or defensiveness, gazes calmly and firmly right back. So the gazed upon, without aggression or defensiveness, gazes calmly and firmly right back. And this woman says, this was such a special moment for me. I heard the clank of loosened chains. So in these tantric texts, which I'm exploring, these women had relationships with men in this time, and they were mutually enhancing, where they were cooperating in these dynamic religious relationships that enhanced both of them. So men and women were coming together in this time as equals, and together really mutually enhancing each other. This dynamism and this rapport was happening between men and women. And the word tantra, like the root word is tan, and it means to weave So in this tantric movement, lots of things were being woven together that before had been a little separate. So coming into life, practitioners were beginning to weave their depth into sexuality, into their relationship with death, into their relationship with food, into their relationship with speaking to each other. And men and women were really interweaving together, and this dynamism between them both was enhancing this inner process. And the women really needed the men there, the generosity of that male gaze, the generous gaze, not the hostile one, but a generous one to allow this depth to rise out of the women and become a blessing. And allow the women to have this undefended, unprotected, vulnerable heart. A heart that can really flow out, that feels safe to just flow out. It's not holding back. And this flow outwards of the woman's heart, of her juice to flow, benefits everyone, benefits the whole culture. It's said in the text that the more life is flowing through a woman, the more powers of the universe begin to flow from the woman's Shakti. The women are possessors of special spiritual potency, vessels and channels of energy, that she is the earth-like foundation, that she gives rise to life and well-being on all levels. And that this flow outwards is really needed in the world in these times. That also this flow, as a woman starts to wake up, a very clear discernment, like a crispness comes into play that can just cut through crap and plant us in what's deeply important. So I've spoken before about when our practice starts to deepen, that sometimes a demand is put on us. That as our practice deepens, sometimes deeper sufferings work their way through us. And sometimes this can feel like an assault, but it's actually the grace, like the kindness, wanting us to extend our hearts even more than we thought was possible. It's like a demand to keep on going and to extend. And in every practice, there's a kind of time when this starts to happen, if real fear starts to move through the being, or things that you would think would make you want to turn away, but actually are invitations to deepen even more. That feeling of stepping out of the cocoon a little more, and to widen our embrace and to bring light through even more density that's happening through the being. To stay steady to love in the midst of whatever's happening, if it's divorce or it's this or that, but to deepen in and to stay steady to love. And so this inner movement was reflected in this wider tantric movement, where there was a movement out of the monasteries, out of the stronghold of the monasteries, more into relational practices. It was in the, a little bit of history. So it was in the 8th and 12th century. It was called like the crowning achievement of the time by some people. This sense of deepening love out of the walls and into life. The virtue and the concentration, such as what we've been developing here together really, this altruistic motivation of love was then, you know, brought directly into life. So there was a sense of inclusiveness in this movement, that it wasn't just with the monks, but that anybody could come into the divine. So it drew people from all different competing faiths to come together. It drew washerwomen and prostitutes and fishermen and monks, and all people were coming together, and it was cutting through caste systems and saying, look, we can all I'm saying this is when it's working well, you know, but we can all come together and really mutually enhance each other and have the generosity of the gaze to draw each other out. The 8th and the 12th century in India. So there was this sense, and what we've been practicing here is this profound engagement with life, like coming into the dark and fleshy bits, and a heart that can deeply see through ingrained habits and see what's bright and alive and fresh. So this movement was seriously challenging some of the views of women that had begun to be generated in the monasteries, which I've also spoken about before. So some of the practices that monks were practicing to work with desire, which denigrated women's sexuality in a way, with the deep wish to protect the jewel that doesn't need anything to awaken. They were saying no, no, no to women, no to desire, no, no. But in that no, there was some denial starting to happen, which I spoke about, I think, a bit clearer than that before. So this movement was really putting women back in the fore of practice. So in this time, a lot of new women came into the texts. A lot of different yoginis were being spoken about and written about, introduced and remembered. And that there was a feeling that there was something very unique, something very sublime, something very bliss-bestowing that women could bring to the process. And so, as I was saying, men and women would meet together and chant and dance and feast and eat and come into union to conduct this bliss and this energy through their beings. And it was said that the most excellent place for yogis is wherever there is a gathering of yoginis. It said that that all magical powers will be attained from being with those blissful ones. So that's quite a radical shift. So there was a deep cleansing in this movement of prejudice. A very ancient entrenched habits were starting to loosen. And there was the feeling that perhaps this inner jewel couldn't only be found in solitude, in depth of samadhi and solo practice, but perhaps it could also really be found in relationships, in life, in daily life. And that things that had been separate could really come together, like depth of innocence and virtue meeting passion. Virtue and innocence meeting passion. Depth and light really interweaving and working together. So I spoke a little about Vajra Yogini. So she was one of the main rising figures in this movement. And when I think of Vajra Yogini, I think of some words by Mirabai, the poet, who says, "I do not observe the rules of worldly decorum. Fearlessly, sister, I will beat the drum. The lightning is dancing without shame. The lightning is dancing without shame. Every limb in my body throbs with joy." So Vajra Yogini is red, like a blood orange red, like vivid red, bright red, with long black hair, like your hair. She's naked often and dancing, and this essence is fully revealed. She's untamed, and she's known as the Supreme Liberator, that she will use her knife to chop off any self-centered state, to awaken men and women to the brightness of their hearts, to their depth. She often has a retinue of yoginis with her, and then when she so chooses, a yogi that she will come into union with. She says, chattering fools who disparage women. One should honor women. They are heaven, truth. The fire of transformation lives in them. Women are Buddha. Women are religious community. Women are the perfection of wisdom. And she goes on and she says, one should not strike a woman. And you think of India these times, like what was happening against women was really severe, you know. So it's not like this was really coming to really say, hey, wake up. One should not strike a woman, even with a flower. Even if she commits 100 terrible deeds, one must not denigrate women in whatever social class they are born, for they are the lady of the perfection of wisdom, embodied in the phenomenological world. And so Vajra Yogini herself is fully formless, bliss formless, not actually in a body, but she embodies, so women know how possible it is for them to wake up. For the benefit of women who do not know I exist in form, I come. For they're my holy bodies, she says, and by seeing me, they will be inspired and encouraged to keep going. And meditating on me, that supreme pride in the innate divinity, the inner light, will rise and combat all self-doubt. Vajra Yogini speaks about what she calls there is a snaky strength which starts to rise if we let it, that rises up and comes out and helps the world to dance with more freedom. So it was also part of this movement was coming into a fearless encounters with life and with the life inside of us. So it's coming to that depth of reference, a vastness of which we can see our experience from. So they would kind of go into the places where we hold the most psychological neuroses, say, where we grip the tightest. They would kind of go in willingly. So they were trying to deep entrenched habits. They were really trying to draw the light into those places. So they would often visit cemeteries, like where death was so clear. And they would engage in sexuality where there's so much, you know, holding because of all the ways we've hurt each other and so forth. They're trying to break down conventional social dualistic thoughts, such as caste systems and women can't make it, or really cut through to get the deep freshness. And trying to do this in a very swift, immediate way. So these deities, these women, would often terrify or shock or be repulsive to try and evoke a very strong response that would open the doors of the being. And, you know, life will do this to us. To wake up, you know, we experience a divorce or a separation or a death of a loved one, where we go, oh, you know, life. So this is this kind of movement. Feels wanting like every corner in the being to be filled with light, that there couldn't be a corner of shame left. So it's really going to this shamelessness where every habit of mind would be met with love. So it's a deep practice of love, of loving. To continue to stretch your heart around your experience, no matter how shocking it can sometimes be. So, along with these women that were coming into the whole realm of Buddhist thought, there were the wrathful deities, so deities that looked so scary, but were really just full of this heart, but pretended to be so scary. And they were wanting us to not believe in these fearsome appearances, these hostile appearances to our own judgments, to really allow us to come into contact with negativity and stay steady in love and see deeper, but through going into it. So to stop seeing hostile threats from other people or from our own inner life as threats to the ego, but more appearances that come and go, not getting so worked up. Like with the nightmares that many people have reported to me, like, oh, like really scary dreams, you know. Some of the dreams that have happened in here, I've heard them like horror movies. But learning to just, appearances, to allow them to come, just to keep allowing these movements. To not spin into reactions of our own negativity. And so I just wanted to be clear again that these tantric people weren't thrill seekers, like going into dangerous places for thrills, to get kicks. Like it was a movement of so much love and so much preparation of self-kindness, of softness, so that these wild places could be met with such tenderness and such care. That through that care, in the midst of real horrors, that we could still locate each other in the heart. And so I had an experience with one of these wild Dakinis once. I realised this just the other day, that this story came to me, and I thought about it again. But it was when after I'd been living in the shack, and then in the shack, by the coast for a year, and then in the little shack for a year, and been quite deep in practice and in solitude, I came back to Melbourne. And I needed to get some money because I wanted to go back to India. And so I got a job as a carer. And I know you've worked as a carer before. Yeah. And I'd never done this work before, but I was very surprised how quickly they gave me the job. And the first job I had was really intense. Like, and what I had to do, like straight away, was, you know, lifting this woman into this hoist and catheter and, you know, giving... Probably don't need to go into that bit, but I mean, like literally, well, we're speaking about these messy things, so like literally having to, no, I won't actually.
Give it a while.
Okay. No, so okay, I'm okay. So I was given the task of I was given the task of caring for a woman who had only 3 months ago had lost all movement from her neck down. She was a woman who was about to get married to a man. She had a car accident with the man and banged into some tree, and he was fine, but she became quadriplegic, couldn't move from the neck down, and it makes me feel sad. And then her partner was fine. So totally fine, but he bailed. So I was sent out to her, and she was about 45 minutes down the highway from where I was living. And I swear I felt like I was a young nun, monk, because then I was still a bit unsure about what I was. Driving down to meet this woman, and it was night shifts. It was night shifts. So I remember, and I had to dress quite well, so I had to go and buy some, because I'd been quite wild, had to dress nicely. So I drive down the road, and I had to do many things with her. So I was, like, through the night, so I'd sleep the night there, and the house was always really warm, like 28 degrees or something, so she wouldn't bruise or in the night, something like that. And so through the night, at exact times, like every hour, I would have to turn her over in the bed. Just the two of us in this house, like way past Sandringham. And I had to feed her everything. And, you know, help her poo. So I had to, that's what I was going to say before, but she actually said I was the best at that. She would say I was the best at helping her go to the toilet. And so she, as you could imagine, was managing, but she was secretly, you know, totally distraught, totally full of shame. She wouldn't leave the house. The other carers were trained nurses, so they had like a way of dealing with her. So they were very like bright and fresh. Hey, Maria, let's put up the curtains today, and how are you feeling? And, you know, they'd managed the gravity of her pain with this bright way of working, sort of brisk, you know, and I was not skilled in that. So when I first met her, she looked at me and she was like, ah, and she didn't quite know like what to kind of do with me. And she was incredibly hard to be around, because her pain was coming out in a very insane level of, as you can imagine, control and aggression. So if I did anything wrong, it would be, shh, Jessie, or, you know, like really, like I would be in the kitchen, like cutting up her fruit salad. And if she heard like one tiny tap of like the fork on the bench, she would be, oh, I just hear this huge groan like from the room, like, okay. And so, you know, and if I did something wrong, and like, if I did something wrong, she had a list of the carers, and if you'd done something she didn't like, she'd lower you on the list. So she'd made this. So every week you'd come in and you'd see where you were on the list, like, oh. And so she was very, and I had to put the oxygen mask on and not get any hair in her, you know, hair in the face. And she liked to princess tuck before she went to sleep, like, so I tucked the blanket around a certain way around her neck, and you have to put these socks on so she wouldn't, the socks to hug her legs together. And so it was very, like, I had seriously about a book of notes of how to care for her. And I'd practice on friends before I went, like rolling them over and sliding across without causing her discomfort. And so, at the same time that this was happening was September 11. That happened as I was at her house. So I was at her house sitting with her, and together we were watching, you know, the planes coming in, and we were hearing, you know, the sounds of the people. And I remember the tenderness in those people just before they died, when they were ringing their family, like a graciousness, actually. And I remember being so struck, like, I just want you to know I love you and we're okay. And the majority was of that ilk. So I was with Marie. That's not her name. Let's call her Maria. So this was happening, and that night she was like a dragon, kind of, this night. And she was really starting to kind of yell and be abusive to me. And I was like, like, I could so feel, you know, that like this control and intensity, what she'd suffered, like, was beyond what I could imagine how you could digest. You know, to digest that level of loss. But at the same time, I was like, but I'm a human, and you're a human, And I came back and I said, Maria, I'm actually here trying to help you. Will you just let me? And boom, she was like, whew. She stopped. And then she said, I can be such a bitch, can't I? And I said, yes. I just decided to, but my heart was still there. I said, yes. And then she was like, she softened, and I put her to bed very tenderly, did all the tucking and everything. And then that night, and I wouldn't hardly sleep, like, because thinking when I had to go in and turn her. And that night, it was like the house was full of, like, the most intense pain. Like, I thought, we talk about samsara, but, you know, these people dying in September 11 and coming out of that time and being with Maria, who had such a huge loss. And I lay there just feeling it, and I was feeling her howling. Like, the experience was just of this howling coming from the inside of her. So I thought, stuff it. I will not be fooled by her appearances. And I walked in and I, oh yeah, one other thing just to tell you, that she painted with a, she began to paint with a, using her mouth. And I'd seen the paintings. So I'd known that there was something alive. Beautiful little moodscapes of just like, psh, like really delicate strokes of colour. And I don't know, they kept me kind of wanting to stay with her. So I went into the room and I just said, you know, how are you? And she was crying. And so I just jumped up and sat on the bed next to her. And I just dived in. I just held her head, just started stroking her face. She said, you know, people don't usually do this. I said, I know, but I'm going to India soon, so let's just, you know, dive in. And so I just stroked her face and she cried. My God, I loved being able to move. I loved making love. I loved, and it's all gone, you know. So I just kept stroking her and slowly just this level of intimacy came into the room, like this feeling of love and care, and we were sort of smiling and we dropped into this depth of space, and I was like, but there are, I've seen in your paintings, there are spaces inside of you that move, that are bright, that are rich. Mm. She goes, yes, yes, yes. I feel that when I paint. There's just this inner life. And I don't know, we just slowly this conversation came, like, about what is beyond the body. What is this richness that gives us life? And we proceeded, and then she began actually to talk to me and said, you know, what she'd perceived in me. She was like, you know, where have you come from? Like, you've got a very good heart, but not much etiquette. Like, you were stumbling a bit with someone, you know, whatever. And she was saying to me, look, like, don't keep going. You know, these words were coming out of her, like, keep going, don't stop, don't stay in the monasteries, don't stay in the shacks that you've been in, like, come into life, you know. So we had this night and, you know, I turned her over, and depth of love. In the morning, she was pretty horrible again. But I knew that we'd touched it, you know, we'd really touched something. And before, after that, we couldn't, you know, there was a transmission, there was something between us that was happening. So something about, you know, that, and the other thing I was going to say is, I did not really have a clue, like, at first how to do everything that I was meant to do, but I just had to fake it until I made it. Like, there was that sense of acting, like, just going in, and I'd be, okay, Maria, I'm going to make you your food, and I know how to do it, and I'll cook you this, and I'm going to lift up the things. And if I did it with this certitude, she would relax. And it was through my kind of just offering that spaciousness to all her hostile appearances that something began to really come through, in a way, I felt. I don't know how she is now, it would be curious. But she was quite amazing. When she would come through, like, what was in her was beautiful. So it says in the text that a woman is no more depleted by providing religious nourishment than is a mother by nursing a child or a candle flame lighting many lamps. So as the brightness can start to come, that sense of keeping one's own dignity in the act of giving, the fullness, to be able to say, yes, you're being a bitch, even though you have just lost your whole body. And then to allow that to, the truth of the response opened up the intimacy. So how we can keep that uncompromising truth with the love. It said that when a woman reclaims her innate divinity, she does not need to seek outer approval so much, for a bottomless reservoir of self-esteem emanates from the depths of her being. So the ways that men and women are deeply linked, I wonder how the men are going with this, but how men and women are deeply linked is that it's also man's, in the tantra, in these texts, I'm kind of talking traditionally, for the man to stay steady to his seeing of the woman's divinity and protecting her as she slowly feels safe to really let go. So in the way that the men here have been coming down to the lake when the women swim, that I know all the women are really thankful for, but having those protectors to then go into the water. There is something in this movement about that generous male gaze that can stay steady through all the appearances of the woman and just keep kind of feeling into the heart. And what then that does, and we can speak about this as men and women, and so I'm not wanting to, whatever preferences are here, it's all included. Just talking within this model right now. But from that generosity of the man, then the grace that can flow to him from the woman, like what actually comes through to nourish then him or her, the trust is very potent. You know, there's been so much bolstering up for all of us, like bolstering up and this really learning to relaxing and really being with each other and feeling each other is what this movement's asking for. So in a lot of the texts, a man's progress was kind of measured by how he could see these dakinis and not be fooled by their hostile appearances. So he had to go through quite a lot of initiations in the texts to kind of stay steady to, no, there's something here, to not run away in fright when the woman's getting really moody or, you know. And the movement was trying to really unlock in all of us these prejudices and this level of shame. We're trying to unlock and open these through each other. So there's a few stories I have. So we have Atisha. Has anybody heard about Atisha in the Tibetan tradition? Mm-hmm. Yes. So he's quite well known, but he's not really well known for how he was initiated. So once Atisha, who's one of the kings of Tibetan Buddhism, was walking along and he met one of these naked women. She had a necklace of bones and skulls. She looked like a skeleton. She was laughing at one moment and then weeping crazily the next, like she'd been in her cycle at that time. But he felt something about her. He was like, there's something happening here, like this unconventional appearance. He read some of the texts, like they were all reading them. And these texts came in back into the monasteries, you know, like they began to be really respected. So he was probably thinking, ooh, there must be something in here. So he mentally bowed down to her and he said, if you've got anything for me that can just open me up to love more, give it to me. And she looked at him. She said, you must come to Eastern Bengal. Follow me. He was like, He was just seeing how steady he could be. He was like, but Atisha was onto it. He was like, yep. And they reached a cremation ground. And he was like, okay. Something's really going to happen because we've gone to the place of death. And then she says to him, I find this very classically feminine, I don't know if you will, but she says, how did you guess that I had something to impart? Do I look like I do? These traits still be there. That's why before we said we almost don't need reassurance, but some is still very helpful. And he said, yes, you certainly do, laughing and crying and walking around naked. And then very pleased with him, she initiated him. And it goes on about their lovemaking and that. So that was one. So I wanted to do the famous ones first. So the other one was Maitripa. Has anybody heard of Maitripa? I don't know. You probably have. Okay. So Maitripa. So Maitripa was deep in the mountains. And he was searching for this female tantric guru that he had been told about by his teacher. Actually, no, he was actually looking for a man called Savari, a male famous tantric yogi. And he came upon, deep into the woods, and he came upon his teacher in the company of these two wild-looking women. They were called Lotus Eyes and Wisdom Eyes. They had long matted hair, the skirts were woven of bark and leaves. And he thought, what distasteful company is my guru being part of? They were huntresses, so they shot wild pigs. And so first he couldn't believe that his teacher had lowered himself to such company. He was reeling in shock. But then it happened that when he saw this one of the women like shooting this wild pig, he heard this message inside, and it was, shooting the arrow of clear understanding, I slay the boar of ignorance who thinks women can't do it. Now eat the meat of non-duality. Then can't quite understand this. So then, shoot the arrow of ultimate experience. I slay the deer of subject-object. Now eat the meat of non-duality. And so, again, the real target, she was really provoking his judgments, really saying, you know, she was really getting into what he'd thought. So her real target was this, really, was his judgments and his mind. And when he did see this, he really paid homage to them. He began to think, these females might be actually onto something. But it said that his hesitation cost him, and that in that lifetime he didn't reach enlightenment. And it happened the next one. So the texts are really quite strong. I mean, because they were a movement against, you know, there was some oomph because they were against all the eons of disparaging women, so they were kind of like really wanting to hit the point home of this respect. And so there's many, you know, other stories like this of this aversion in these men of appearances of beauty being challenged too. Like Vajrayogini taking the form of like old naked women and coming to monks' houses and saying, make love to me, and like them turning them away and really suffering. Or when they did receive them, then boom, they'd become these gorgeous kind of beauties and they'd be rewarded. So again, it was this generosity of the male gaze to see through appearances and to deepen into feeling the heart and what that heart in the woman wants. So they're also, the women could be quite cutting, like these really cutting remarks too. There was another one, a woman and a man had been, a monk had left, he'd come into company with this wild woman. And they were meditating a lot together. And the man had entered a very deep state for many years. And when he'd first gone into this deep meditative state, his partner had been cooking a curry and he'd really liked the smell. And when he came out of this state, he said, oh, where's that curry? And she was furious by his attachment. So she unleashed her criticism. She said, you need to meditate more. And he was like, okay, I'll go off into solitude. And then she gave even more of a rebuke. And she said, do not sit at home. Do not go into the forest. Recognize your nature wherever you are. Recognize your depth wherever you are. And this became his song, this one monk. Like, he'd go around, do not sit at home. Do not go into the forest. So do not sit in the barn. Do not sit in the lake. Recognize your nature wherever you are. You know, in the midst of anxiety of, you know, we're coming to the end of the retreat and next steps, but recognize your nature wherever you are. So I just, there's just a little more. I just, the other particular feeling in this was really bringing the depth of our practice into what we love to do and what we do every day. So there's stories about, and this weaving into life. There was a one woman who was teaching a monk again who was very tired and couldn't do much, he'd become quite weak, and so he was just stitching a lot, like he was working as a stitcher and threading these blankets together. And he was having real trouble with his practice while he was sewing, of meditating on these deities or some practice he was given. And so she said, envisage the rags you pick and stitch as empty space, as vast space. See your needles as mindfulness and knowledge, and thread these needles with compassion, and stitch so many clothes for all of our fellow sentient beings in all realms. And then he was flooded by compassion through her, like, giving instructions that was so part of his own daily life, that he began laughing crazily. And he was yelling, look at this wonderful cloth this yogi has sewn, like running down the street. And they were both like laughing together crazily and people were walking past. But this intimacy happened between them. And yeah, there's other ones about like women who are winemakers and just seeing that is it too much for one more?
One more?
Okay. So this was a woman called Sahaj Vajra. And she was a winemaker. And she was thinking, oh, maybe if I'm going deep into the Dharma, I have to give up making wine. And then she had this other deep wisdom that was coming through to her. And this voice of life said to her, daughter, all the Buddhas drink wine that isn't made by human hands and is inexhaustible. It's an inexhaustible treasure box. The entrance into the sphere of all Buddhas is this elixir. It's called the sphere beyond thought. Buddha daughter, remain in that meditative state and you will take the primordial wine of innately spontaneous realization that all the Buddhas drink. It will quench your thirst and you will be able to serve at all beings through this actual wine that you make. So this movement of life that's labeled the tantric movement, but it's the movement of life, like into life, and I think it's relevant for all of us because we're not living as monastics, but obviously we're showing how we're being here, such a commitment to the practice, and how we can bring this into our relationships and into the work we do. And what this movement was saying, that the jewel isn't only in the solitude, but it's through the practice that we're doing of really coming into out of numbness and being able to feel our hearts and feel each other, that the jewel can really come in other ways. And so this is what it said in the text. It's this coming into life is finding a jewel hidden within the ordinary world of self-enclosed, separate, habitually numb, insensitive selves whose relationship to one another is routinized and self-referential, often, not all the time. At its worst, we get neurotic and addictive and compulsive. But can we really continue to love ourselves so we can come from a fresher place? I just added that myself. And recover the abandoned jewel. Natural, spontaneous ecstasy that emerges through engaging with life once we're grounded in virtue. So love, enjoyed by the ignorant, can truly become bondage, but that very same love, tasted by one with understanding, becomes liberation. Enjoy all the pleasures, be moved by compassion into the pleasures of love, fearlessly for the sake of liberation. So we'll have some quiet time again, 5 minutes. So may we and all beings everywhere rest back and trust in our own depth. And may any weird views that still live inside of us that have come through being harmed, may they be softened, softened, softened. And we can see what we really are. And radically play with love. And again, just from the depths of my heart, all the women that have traversed the path, all the men and women that have traversed the path, and all the men and women that have really assisted each other and not been moved by ego or control or power, but through deeply wanting to allow each other to come into fullness, men and men and women and women and women and men. May we learn how to really love each other.